So how about you? How was it complicated for you?
Oh, you know, just complicated.
Jones and Ahmed pick their way down the hall, pausing to look at the photos that dot the walls.
Did you spend much time together as a family?
Jones continues.
Birthdays, Christmases, that kind of thing?
I think of the last Christmas we spent together. The ugly words, the gnarled faces, the screaming over the turkey. It wasn't exactly a Hallmark commercial.
I'm sorry, did you say which unit you were from?
I ask. For a moment, I feel like a character out of Law & Order SVU, which is, of course, my only point of reference for police showing up on the doorstep.
We're from Homicide, Jones says evenly. Lucy?
Ollie calls from the next room.
Who is it?
I take a deep breath and walk into the living room. Jones and Ahmed are at my heels. The back door is wide open, and Edie appears to have disappeared. A ball must have landed in our yard. Edie adores nothing more than throwing a ball back over the fence. Ollie stands up, confused.
It's the police, I say.
Ahmed approaches Ollie and extends a hand.
You must be Oliver Goodwin?
Ollie
says, shaking Ahmed's hand. I see Ollie through the police's eyes. He looks like hell. He's wearing navy track pants and a maroon rugby sweater. His hair is a shambles. His skin has an odd grey tone to it. It reminds me of the way he used to look when our kids were newborns and not sleeping, when he would appear in the doorway and beg to go back to sleep just for half an hour, despite the fact that I was the one who'd been up most of the night.
I'm Detective Senior Constable Jones, and this is Detective Constable Ahmed, Jones says. We have a few questions, if you don't mind.
Questions about what? Ollie asks.
There's a pause, then Jones gives a slight chuckle.
About your mother's death?
Ollie's eyes shoot to me and I shrug. Finally, after a second or two, he gestures for the cops to sit down. They do, on the couch.
So what can we do for you?
I ask, sitting beside Ollie on the arm of the armchair.
Do you have any more information about Diana's death?
We don't have the coroner's report yet, Jones says, but we'll have it soon. In the meantime, we're gathering information. You mentioned to Constables Arthur and Perkins that your mother had cancer, is that correct?
It is, I say when Ollie fails to reply. Diana had breast cancer. Jones flicks open a black notebook embossed with a gold police logo and holds her pen poised.
And can you tell me who her doctor was?
Her GP was Dr. Paisley, I say, at the Bayside Medical Clinic.
And her oncologist?
Everyone looks at me. Everyone, including Ollie.
Actually, I'm not sure. She never mentioned her oncologist's name to me.
Jones closes her book. I get the feeling this isn't news to her.
I see.
Ollie blinks.
What do you see?
We haven't found any evidence of your mother's cancer. There is no record of her visiting an oncologist. No mammograms or ultrasounds, no chemotherapy. As far as we can see, she didn't have cancer at all.
Jones seems irritated by this, as though their incompetence is somehow our fault.
Well, obviously you haven't looked in the right place, I say. You can't have checked with every doctor.
There's no referral from Dr. Paisley,
Jones tells us calmly. Her elbows rest on her knees. Her hands are clasped together.
There are no scans or blood test results or anything that might indicate cancer.
I feel my face screw up. This is just ridiculous. People didn't say they had cancer if they didn't. Or perhaps some people did, people with hypochondria or Munchausens, those who wanted to garner sympathy or money or friendship. But Diana hated sympathy and she certainly didn't need money. As for friendship, she hated people fussing around her or offering her so much as a tissue. Diana would never say she had cancer if she didn't. I'm as sure of this as I am of my very existence. And yet...
A problem with the system, Ollie says. That must be it. Why would she say she had cancer if she didn't?
That's what we're trying to figure out.
Ollie shakes his head.
But she committed suicide, that's what you guys said. We don't know that for sure.
Now Ollie seems to snap to attention.
But you said there was a letter?
There was a letter.
Can we read it?
Eventually, but it's currently part of our investigation.
What does that mean?
We're checking it for fingerprints, doing a handwriting analysis.
You think it was forged?
We're trying not to make too many judgments until we know more.
This is ridiculous,
Ollie says, standing up. He begins to pace.
Just ridiculous.
Listen, there is evidence to suggest she committed suicide. The materials, the letter we found in her desk drawer.
I blink. Her desk drawer?
Mom, I'm hungry.
Everyone glances in the direction of the voice. Edie is standing at the back door. Jones and Ahmed rise to their feet.
Who are these people?
Edie asks, walking up to Jones, not stopping until she's practically between her thighs.
My name is Detective Jones,
Jones says.
This is my partner, Detective Ahmed. We're police.
Edie frowns.
But you don't have police clothes on.
Some police don't wear uniforms. But I have a badge. Here, look.
Jones, I notice, has changed temperaments as if on an axis. Suddenly she is perhaps not quite maternal, but certainly friendly and warm. It's clear to me somehow that she doesn't have children of her own, but she appears the type who might very well be someone's favourite aunt.
I think we'll leave it at that for today,
Jones says, taking her badge back from Edie and putting it in her jacket pocket.
But if you think of anything significant or remember Diana's oncologist's name, please do give me a call.
Her tone indicates that she doesn't expect that call to come.
It just doesn't make sense,
Ollie says as they walk toward the front door.
Mum wouldn't lie about having cancer.
But my mind is caught up with something else, something irritating and itchy, like having someone's name on the tip of your tongue. No matter how many times I turn it over, I can't make any sense of it. If you committed suicide, why did you leave the letter in the study drawer, Diana? Why wouldn't you leave it where you knew someone would find it? Chapter 12. Lucy. The Past. A week or two before Archie's first birthday, Ollie and I arrive at Tom and Diana's house. We are immediately shuffled into the front living room, the good room, all the Goodwins call it, which is strange because all the rooms seem pretty good to me. Still, it's a novelty, as we usually gather around bar stools in the kitchen or hang out in the den.
Can I get you another mineral water, Lucy?
Diana asks.
No, I'm fine, thank you.
Diana and Tom's sofa is so plump with stuffing that I have to clutch the armrest for stability. It doesn't help that my knee is doing its nervous bounce thing. Diana does nothing to put me at ease. She is her classic self today, her gaze beady and guarded. She sits right on the edge of the couch, her legs crossed at the knee. Nettie and Patrick were here when we arrived, but after giving us a quick apologetic wave, they made themselves scarce. I wish I could make myself scarce. Diana and I attempt to make small talk about work, mine, never hers, about my dad's health, the precancerous mole he recently had removed, about the 70s zebra-striped jumpsuit and jacket combo I'm wearing, which Diana mistook for pajamas. But I sense Diana's heart isn't in it, and neither is mine. We both want to get on with what we came here for, and it's clear from the fact that Ollie and I suggested this meeting that we want something.
Cheese?
Diana says, holding up an antipasto platter.
No, I say, and we drift back into silence.
Unfortunately, Ollie is still locked in conversation with Tom, long after Diana and I have exhausted all avenues of conversation. Tom, it appears, is talking about the inheritance again. He adores talking about the inheritance and drops it into conversation as often as he possibly can. It reminds me of a child desperate to tell their friend what they'd gotten them as a birthday present before they can tear off the paper. The inheritance, he says, will look after us in our old age.
Admittedly, it's nice to know we'll be looked after, and it does give me some comfort in those times we eat instant noodles for dinner because we can't afford anything else. But at the same time, it feels like poor taste to talk about what we'll get when someone dies before they are dead.
Anyway, we wanted to ask you something, Ollie says, after what seems like an eternity.
Diana and I sit a little straighter.
Tom is the only one who seems surprised that there is a purpose to our visit.
For someone so successful, he really can be quite thick.
We've found a house, Ollie announces. And not a moment too soon, Tom says eagerly.
He, like the majority of Ollie's friends, has been unsettled about the fact that we're renting and likes the security of bricks and mortar for investment.
It's a two-bedroom workers' cottage in South Melbourne, Ollie continues. It's pretty run down, but we could renovate it. We've got a good deposit just short of 20%.
He hesitates here, steals a quick glance at his mother.
Problem is, without a 20% deposit, we'd need to pay mortgage insurance, which is just throwing money down the drain. We hate to ask, but... South Melbourne, eh?
Tom says.
A good spot. Close to the city, near the market, near Albert Park Lake. It's not easy for you young folk, is it? Everything is so expensive. I read the other day that a lot of kids are not buying their first home until they're in their 40s. Can you believe that? What do you think, Di?
Tom is the only one I've ever heard call Diana Di. Once I heard him call her Lady Di. The strangest part was, Diana had actually smiled. Tom brought out an entirely different side to her, a softer side. Unfortunately, now Diana doesn't look soft. Her lips are pressed tightly together as though she's trying to break something with her teeth.
Life has never been easy, she says finally, folding her hands primly in her lap. Every generation has its challenges, and I dare say most have had to suffer through worse than unaffordable housing. You and Lucy both have good heads on your shoulders. If you want this house badly enough, I don't doubt you'll make it work. Otherwise, you'll find something else, something you can afford.
Silence follows. Deafening silence. I stare at the swirls of the rug on the floor, unable to meet her gaze. After a moment or two, I steal a look at Ollie and Tom, who both look disappointed, though not surprised.
Diana, Tom starts,
but Diana is already holding up a hand.
You asked what I thought, that's what I think. Now that's all I'm going to say on the matter.
Diana uproots herself from the overstuffed couch.
Will you kids be staying for dinner?
Ollie and I stare at her, blinking.
I'll take that as a no,
she says, and disappears out of the room.
I'll walk you out, Tom says.
No, no, I say hurriedly. Don't get up, please, we can see ourselves out. I expect Tom to insist, but he just nods.
Rightio then, you kids take care.
I am sick with mortification. What were we thinking asking Diana for money? Suddenly it seems so obvious. With what Ollie has told me about his upbringing, how Diana insisted he and Nettie be raised with part-time jobs and second-hand cars and an understanding that not everyone is as privileged as them, of course Diana wasn't going to be in favour of giving them a handout. Sure, they'd gone to private schools and had some pretty amazing holidays, at Tom's insistence, but they'd also spent weekends picking up donations for her charity and serving at the local soup kitchen. The worst part is, as humiliated as I am, Diana had made some very good points when she'd turned us down. Other generations had had it harder. Ollie and I did have the ability to get a house within our means, which means I can't even hate her for what she said. As we reach the foyer, Nettie and Patrick materialize, as if from nowhere. How'd it go? Nettie whispers. Her face is apologetic, as if she already knows exactly how it went. Did she give you the spiel about how every generation has its challenges? Ollie nods.
But if we want it badly enough,
you'll make it work. Nettie and Ollie all chuckle quietly. Commiserations, Patrick says. He's obviously been sampling some of Tom's top-shelf drinks while we were being given the lay of the land, because he smells of whiskey. Thank goodness for Dad, eh? Nettie says. If it wasn't for him, we'd all be left penniless on the street.
What are you talking about? I ask.
Oh, don't look so worried, Lucy, Nettie says, putting an arm around my shoulders. Dad's not going to let you miss on your house. He's probably already written Ollie a check, am I right, Ol?
Ollie pats his jeans pocket and grins.
What? I say. We all knew Mum wouldn't go for it. She never does.
He glances at Nettie, who nods.
We also knew Dad would.
So that, I point toward the good room, was what exactly? A performance you put on for your mother's benefit?
Ollie, Nettie and Patrick all look mildly perplexed. It is like everyone is in on a joke I don't understand.
Ollie gives a small, hapless grin.
I mean, I guess so. It's no big deal, Luce. It's just the way the Goodwins do things.
Now it's my turn to look perplexed. I shake my head, sincerely stunned.
Well, I'm sorry to tell you that the Goodwins are going to do things differently from now on.
Can you pull over, please? I ask as soon as we are out of Tom and Diana's driveway. Ollie glances at me, then sighs, and the car rolls to a stop.
Please don't ever involve me in these games with your parents again.
Ollie pulls up the handbrake and shifts in his seat so his knees are angled toward me. He is attempting, I know, to be conciliatory.
I told you, Luce, this is just how it works in our family. You heard Nettie, it's just the process.
The process? I blink hard. What does that even mean?
Don't you and your dad have processes around money? Like when we got married, you asked him for money then.
I never asked him for anything. He offered to pay for our wedding.
But you knew he would offer. That's a process, kind of.
Ollie smiles a little, but it slides away when I don't return it.
Listen, I'm sorry, you're right. I shouldn't have involved you.
You shouldn't have involved yourself. I look at the dashboard. Your mother was right. We're adults, we're smart. We need to take responsibility for our own lives now. I don't want to ask them for money again, not for a house, not for a car, not for a litre of milk, okay?
Okay, just hang on a minute.
I'm serious, Ollie. We'll pay the mortgage insurance and buy the house ourselves. This is a deal breaker for me.
A deal breaker?
Yes. Ollie takes a deep breath, lets his head fall back against the headrest. Silence hangs between us, and I can feel Ollie wrestling with it. It's hard, I get that. It's instinctive to reach out to your parents for help when you need it. Everyone does it. It's as familiar and comfortable as getting dressed in the morning. But at some point in adulthood, you have to teach yourself a new way to be. It's infuriating that Diana had to be the one to teach me that. Finally, Ollie nods.
Okay, fine. I'll never ask them for money again.
Even if we're poor and starving and can't find a crumb between us?
Even then.
He gives me a resigned smile.
There is no one I'd rather starve with than you.
We laugh, and I find myself impressed with the speed in which Ollie came around. I wonder if it's because, in the back of his mind, he knows that we will never have to starve. He knows that at some point a huge amount of money will be coming our way, more money than we could possibly know how to spend. And to access it, all we need to do is wait for someone to die.
Chapter 13. Diana. The Past.
The kids have barely left the house before Tom starts pouting. I knew this would happen with the same certainty that he knew I was going to turn down Ollie's request for money. When you've been married for as long as we have, while you may hope for different results, you stop expecting them. And if you want a happy marriage, you have to look to the other things, the things you do see eye to eye on. Lucky for me, when it comes to Tom, there are many of these. Tom sits heavily in his wingback chair. I hold up a hand, palm forward. I know what you're going to say, Tom, so please save it. Did I say anything?
He lets out a long, world-weary sigh. I don't like being the bad guy, Tom, you know that. He shifts in his seat, his expression resigned rather than annoyed.
I do know that.
As far as arguments between Tom and I go, this is as heated as they get. Once upon a time, Tom had more fire to him, but now there's only a handful of things that really make him fly off the handle. Traffic, people leaving lights on around the house, racism, you know, the important things. Today, despite our differing views, Tom and I respect where the other is coming from. Tom grew up in the outskirts of Melbourne, where the suburbs meet the country, a low socioeconomic area even before he was orphaned and had to move further out to live with his grandparents. He was schooled in a rough area and left at 14 to do his apprenticeship with a local plumber. Once qualified, he found himself a job on a residential development project, befriended the owners, and suggested they try their hand at retirement communities. A suggestion so profitable, he wound up a business partner in one of the largest residential development companies in Australia. I would have thought that you of all people would understand that you don't have to be given a handout to succeed, Tom. But things are different now, he says. Everyone is going to university, working for free to get experience using their private school networks. It's harder than in my day. But of course, this is just part of the waffle that private school parents tell each other to justify the exorbitant fees they pay. After Tom badgered me for years, I finally relented and allowed Ollie and Nettie to attend schools with term fees high enough to feed an entire Afghan village for a year. Years later, I'm still doubtful as to whether the schools were any better than the local ones. What I am sure about is that giving children handouts, no, not children, adults, after they have already been privately educated and given every advantage in life simply to keep pushing them further ahead of those who are trying to make their way without assistance, is not the right thing to do for anyone involved. It's always been hard, Tom. You were hungrier for it than our kids are, that's all. Unlike Tom, I grew up in a fairly middle-class family. We didn't have the kind of wealth Tom and I live with now, but we were comfortably off. The fact is, I wouldn't have been hungry for it either if my circumstances hadn't taken a drastic dive in my youth. I think Ollie could do with being a little hungry. A little hunger is good for young people. It was the making of you. Tom slides over, and I sit beside him in the wingback chair, which is generous enough for two middle-aged bottoms. Actually, Tom smiles. It was the making of you. 1970. Cynthia and I called it the Summer of the Falcon, mostly because the rest of our friends were in Europe and we wanted to make it sound more exciting than it really was. The Falcon XRGT was a car, and it belonged to Cynthia's boyfriend, Michael. I knew, of course, what happened in the back of the Falcon, what Michael and Synth had done in the Falcon many times. I wasn't desperately in love with David, though I liked him well enough. He was tall, and he was studying engineering at university, which seemed to be enough back then. Height and smarts, what else could a woman want? As it turned out, when I discovered I was pregnant, David's smarts came in useful. There's a place in Broadmeadows, he said, a home for unwed mothers. You go there, you have the baby, and then you come back. You can just tell everyone you went to Europe. I was glad he hadn't suggested the other type of place you went as an unwed mother, an abortion clinic. I may not have been the most maternal of girls, but I'd always been a believer in taking responsibility for your actions. It wasn't the poor baby's fault that I'd gotten into the back of the Falcon with David. I didn't see why it should have to pay the ultimate price for it. My mother agreed that David's plan was wise, and my father tended to agree with my mother when she thought something was wise. The idea that I would have to give my baby away before leaving the home was a thought so far off in the distance that I didn't even bother to think about it. After all, when you're drowning and someone offers you a life raft, you don't check it for punctures before climbing aboard. Are you feeling all right? David asked me the night before I left for Orchard House. He waved a hand vaguely in front of my midsection, indicating he was asking about pregnancy-related symptoms.
I'm fine.
It was a warm evening and I was sitting on the brick steps of my parents' bungalow with a bag of grapes in my lap. I'd had morning sickness for nearly 6 months, and grapes were the only thing that staved it off. I'd put off my secretarial course and told my friends I was spending a semester in Sicily. No one apart from my parents and David knew the truth. Not even Cynthia. Turned out that Catholic shame fell harder than I'd thought. I'd only seen David a couple of times since I'd been accepted into Orchard House. While I'd been lying low, David, apparently, had been working around the clock to help my father pay for the home. My father had been impressed with David's commitment to help. I'd once heard him tell Mother that he'd been glad I was consorting with an honourable sort of boy, at least. I remember looking through the crack in my bedroom door one evening and seeing my father shaking David's hand while my mother thanked him profusely. In contrast, my father had barely looked at me in months.
"Maybe I'll see you again when you get out," he said.
"Maybe," I agreed, but we both knew it was a lie. My mother drove me to Orchard House.
"It won't be forever," she said at the door,
giving me a brusque kiss and hurrying back to the car. I was startled that this was the extent of her goodbye, but I forced myself not to call her back. I was humiliated enough as it was. After a moment or two, a pinched-looking woman in a navy pinafore came to the door. She opened the security door and surveyed me silently.
"You must be Diana," she said. "Well, you'd better come inside."
Orchard House had the look and feel of a hospital. It was 3 floors high, with wide halls, linoleum floors, and vinyl furniture. Matron took me up the stairs to the 2nd floor, which had a communal area in the centre and burgundy doors around the edges, presumably leading to dormitories. Pregnant women in small clusters looked up when I entered, then quickly down again.
"You're among the oldest at Orchard House,"
Matron told me, leading me around the edge of the room.
"The youngest is a girl named Pamela, who you'll be sharing with. Pamela is just 14.
Matron tutted with disapproval.
"We only exchange first names at Orchard House, and we don't talk about the schools we went to, the people we know, or anything that can distinguish us to the outside world. It's to protect your identities," she said.
But I suspected it was more to protect our parents' identities. Matron stopped just shy of a door, which I assumed led to my room.
"You should know that Pamela is a little troubled. I thought an older, well-spoken girl like yourself might be able to help her, teach her how to behave properly."
She gestured inside, where a girl sat on one of the twin beds. She wore a sour expression, and her hair in 2 greasy plaits.
"Pamela," Matron said, "this is your new roommate, Diana."
"Hello," I said, as Pamela looked resolutely at the floor.
"Don't look so glum," Matron said to her. "You girls are lucky. Your families have helped you. If you keep your head down until you have your baby, you can return to your old lives and forget this ever happened. Not everyone is as fortunate."
Matron left us then, telling me to make myself at home. As I sat on the narrow twin bed opposite the strange, reticent girl, I felt the tears stack up in my eyes, but I brushed them away. After all, I was lucky. After dinner that night, I went to the communal area, which was filled with pregnant girls on brown vinyl couches watching the television or staring at novels. At one table, a girl sat painting another girl's nails a pretty pale pink that reminded me of Cynthia's nails.
"May I sit here?"
I asked a blonde girl on the couch, who was in her pajamas and slippers, her hair pinned up in rollers. She was chatting to the girls on her right, and she slid along without looking up. The couch was startlingly uncomfortable, but as I wasn't sure I could physically stand again, I didn't bother trying to move. All around the room, girls were pinned to their seats by their enormous watermelon-shaped bellies. I counted 17 girls, 17 watermelons. Pamela was the only one who didn't sit. She stood by the bookshelves to the right of the television, ostensibly choosing a book, but mostly fidgeting. She was one of those types that couldn't sit still, I noticed. She was jittery, anxious. It was distracting. The blonde girl, Laurel, I found out, talked quietly to the two girls on her right. As I eavesdropped, I found out that this was her second time at Orchard House. She'd been here 2 years earlier when she was just 16. Funnily enough, rather than people finding this startling and horrifying, as I did, she was treated as a celebrity of sorts and regarded as the fountain of all knowledge about Orchard House. As I listened, conversation drifted from the terrible food to Matron's crush on Arthur the gardener to Laurel's suspicion that one of the girls was pregnant with her own brother's baby. The banter, inane as it was, reminded me of conversations with my own friends and made me feel lonely and comforted in equal parts. At 10 minutes to 10, Matron appeared. 10 minutes until lights out, girls! Matron had a shrill voice that pierced the air and knocked any sense of normality out of the room. Come on now, don't dilly-dally. She disappeared, and the girls dutifully shuffled their hips to the edge of the couch, ready to hoist themselves to standing. I found out via the girls' grumbling that the lights did indeed go out at 10 p.m, and if you weren't in your room, you had to find your way back there in pitch darkness. 10 minutes until lights out, Matron said again. Don't dilly-dally. We all glanced at the door again.
If you dilly-dally, I won't be able to dilly-dally with Arthur after lights out.
Matron was nowhere to be seen. A slow giggle broke out across the room as everyone glanced around. I noticed Pamela's back was to us.
Pamela, Laurel cried, delighted. Was that you?
Pamela bent over, fiddling with the spine of a book, pretending not to hear. If she was doing the impersonation, no one could deny that it was spot on.
Oh, Arthur, stop that, came Matron's voice again. Oh, go on then, don't stop.
The giggles became a fever-pitched chortle.
Just take me into your shed and I'll... What are you girls still doing in here?
The voice was louder now, more shrill. Our heads swung toward the doorway where Matron, actual Matron, stood, hands on hips.
Didn't I tell you not to dilly-dally?
Right away, Matron, Pamela said, and she was the first one to exit the room.
Our bellies grew. We weren't told much about what was coming. We guessed when our babies were due by the size of our bellies. In public, we talked about our pregnancies insofar as they affected our bodies. My bladder is the size of a walnut, or I can hardly walk up this flight of stairs. But we didn't talk about the babies as such. No one told us not to, we just didn't. A natural form of self-protection, perhaps. I avoided making friendships, which was surprisingly easy when you were forbidden to talk about who you were and where you came from. In any case, I'd never been much good at small talk. During the day, Pamela didn't talk to me at all. I tried to teach her things, as Matron had asked, how to speak nicely, how to sew. But each time I tried, she just stared at me or rolled her eyes or muttered under her breath. Once, as I was showing her how to hold cutlery properly, she picked up a fork and threw it across the room. The problem, I realized, was that Pamela was damaged. I wasn't sure how to teach her not to be damaged. Pamela's impersonations became a nightly ritual. She could do almost anyone. Dr. Humbert, the obstetrician with the bushy mustache who came by once a week to take our blood pressure, Arthur, the gardener and Matron's love interest, any of the girls. She was a master at finding people's quirks, the tiniest detail that brought the impersonation to life. Every evening she stood by the bookshelves and we waited. It was my solace, these few minutes of giggles each day. It didn't occur to me until later that it might be a comfort for her too. a few minutes of being someone else. One night, when I'd been at Orchard House nearly a month, she impersonated me.
Oh yes, I'm Diana. I know how to use cutlery and talk posh.
Everyone giggled, even me. Perhaps it was her tone that made it funny rather than mean-spirited. Or maybe it was because it was the first time she'd acknowledged me at all. A part of me was glad to realize that someone in here knew I existed. One night, as we gathered in the communal area, someone noticed Mary wasn't there.
She went into labor last night,
Laurel, her roommate, told us, her voice hushed. Everyone gathered in close. We knew that people went to have their babies, but we were starved of logistics. It was rare to get any actual details.
It was pretty tough. She waited as long as she could before she called Matron. She didn't want to go to the hospital.
That had been a surprise. Mary had been one of the braver girls. She'd been saying for weeks she couldn't wait to get her baby out, that when it was all over she was going to buy a pair of hip-hugging flares and a bottle of whiskey.
Why didn't she want to go?
Someone asked, the question on everyone's lips. 16 pairs of eyes gawped at Laurel.
Because you go into the hospital with a baby, she said, and you leave without one.
Later, when Matron came to announce lights out, we were all animated.
Did Mary have her baby, Matron?
Laurel asked. Matron looked guarded. No one used the word baby with Matron. Even Dr. Humbert had managed to avoid using it, at least in front of us.
She did,
Matron said eventually. We all waited. I noticed Pamela by the bookshelves, standing so still, I doubted she was breathing.
What did she have, a boy or a girl?
The baby was healthy, Matron said, and that was the last time I heard her say the word baby at Orchard House. After news of Mary's birth, the impersonation stopped. It was as though for a time we'd forgotten what we were doing there, but then just like that, we remembered. During the day, Pamela barely spoke at all. But at night, when we lay in bed, she sometimes said a few words. Something vulnerable happened to you at night at Orchard House. You took off your clothes, you took off your armor.
I think I'm having a girl,
she whispered one night as we lay in our twin beds.
What about you?
In the darkness, I could just about make out the outline of her body under a mound of blankets. It was cold in the room, and her breath was a cloud in the air.
It doesn't matter, I said. It won't be my baby. But what would you call it?
She insisted.
If you were keeping it?
I shook my head. I wouldn't have the faintest idea, Pamela.
I'd call my girl Jane. Jane Pamela. It's pretty, don't you think?
Outside, a car drove past, and a streak of light crossed her bed, illuminating her face. It was light, hopeful, utterly unlike Pamela. A lump filled my throat.
Diana,
Pamela said after a moment.
My friends call me Pammy.
I inhaled sharply, swallowed hard. All at once I felt pinned by the weight of what was coming.
Diana, did you hear me?
Yes, I said, coughing to clear my throat.
I heard you, Pammy.
As our due dates drew closer, Pammy shared a few little details about her life. She told me the father of her baby was a man named Christopher, a doctor. Christopher had a wife, Pammy said, but she didn't love him, only his money. Christopher paid for Pammy to come to Orchard House because he didn't want her to have to lift a finger while she was with child. That's how much he loved her. At least that's what Pammy said. I had my doubts about Pammy's version of events, but I was happy to listen. It was better than when she started talking about the baby.
I wonder if Jane will look like me or Christopher. I bet Jane will be smart like Christopher.
Oh, look, Jane is kicking me. She's a feisty one.
Sometimes when Pammy talked about Jane, I wanted to scream. Pammy wouldn't be allowed to name her baby. She wouldn't even be allowed to hold her. That was hard to think about. As the days moved on, my urge to hold my baby was nearly overwhelming. At night, when I felt it kick and move, I wrapped my arms around my belly. I assumed it would be my only chance to hold it.
I do have a name, I told Pammy one night. For a boy, that is. Oliver. Oliver, Pammy said approvingly. What a lovely posh name. Lovely and posh like you.
Despite my hurt, despite myself, in the darkness, I laughed out loud. One evening, I realized I hadn't seen Pammy all day.
Matron,
I said when she came to tell us it was 10 minutes until lights out.
I haven't seen Pammy today. Has she gone to have her baby?
Matron pursed her lips.
Pamela has been moved.
Moved where? It's too early for her to have her baby.
That's none of your concern.
Matron clapped her hands together twice.
All right, girls, time for bed. Don't dilly-dally.
Matron, I said, louder now, where has Pammy been moved?
Matron turned to look at me, pinning me in her beady gaze.
Are you going to start causing trouble, Diana? That's disappointing. I thought you were one of the more sensible girls.
I felt Laurel tug my hand. I abandoned the conversation with Matron and followed her into the corridor.
Has Pammy been saying anything about wanting to keep her baby?
Laurel said.
No, not really.
I thought about that.
Well, she did give her a name. Her?
I shrugged. She thinks it is a girl. Laurel nodded sadly.
What is it?
I asked.
The same thing happened to Josephine the first time I was at Orchard House. One day she told everyone she decided to keep her baby. The next day Josephine was gone.
She kept her baby? I couldn't keep the awe out of my voice.
We assumed so, Laurel said. But I saw Josephine on the outside a year or so later. After she told Matron she wanted to keep her baby, Matron kept her downstairs in a different room and wouldn't let her see anyone. They put her to work night and day, cleaning, doing dishes, cooking. They said that if she wasn't giving her baby up, she'd have to pay for all of her living and hospital expenses herself, and she needed to start working for them right away. They worked her so hard, she went into labour a month early. And when she had her baby, she hadn't paid off her debt, so they held the baby for ransom. Eventually, she had no choice but to hand the baby over. My guess is that's where Pammy is.
Enough of that chatter, Matron said from the other end of the corridor. Off to bed with you all.
I hoped that Laurel was wrong, that Pammy had got out and was somewhere with Christopher and her baby. I hoped for it, longed for it, but I never really believed it. Mother came to visit when my belly was so round and tight that I couldn't put on my shoes and had been wearing slide-on slippers for weeks. Mother was wearing her hat and gloves, like she was going to church.
I want to keep my baby,
I told her as she sat on the vinyl back chair.
But I need your help.
Diana, Mother said, you're being utterly ridiculous.
I'm not. It's 1970. Single women have babies nowadays.
Mother smiled.
Oh, which women are you referring to?
I didn't know any, of course, but they existed. The news said things were changing, that women were gaining more rights. Apparently, single women were able to access welfare to help them support themselves and their babies.
Meredith is divorced,
I said, because Meredith was the closest thing I knew to a single mother. Unfortunately, it wasn't the best example. My dad's cousin Meredith had left her husband a couple of years ago after finding out he was unfaithful. But divorce had ruined Meredith socially, not to mention financially. Meredith had been tossed out of her family home and last I heard was living in a rented house in Melbourne's West in an industrial area. She'd gotten herself a job, apparently, in a factory cafeteria.
Do you want to end up like Meredith? Mother asked.
I can just leave here, you know, I said defensively. There's no lock on the door. In fact, I had no idea if that was true. In any case, I certainly wouldn't be telling Matron about my plans.
I suppose that's true, Mother said thoughtfully. But what would you do then? Bring the baby back to your father's house? I don't think so.
I'd get my own place.
With what money? Who would rent a house to a pregnant single woman with no qualifications to work?
I'd stay with friends.
Which friends?
I said nothing, trying to make my expression defiant. But I didn't have any friends that could help me. The only friends I had that weren't overseas or at university lived with their parents, most of whom were friends of my parents. I had nowhere to go. My plan was a giant bluff, and my mother was calling it. She placed a cold hand on top of mine.
Come on now, Diana, you're nearly there. Have your baby, come home and make better choices next time.
She kissed my forehead, and the matter, as far as she was concerned, was laid to rest. That night, I ran. Chapter 14. Lucy. The Present. The funeral director's name is Pearl. She's a kindly woman in her mid-50s with a puff of overdyed chestnut hair and the patience of a kindergarten teacher. Thank goodness for her because, as it turns out, there's a lot to do after someone dies. When Tom died, Diana organized everything, and I never appreciated how heroic that was until now. How does one, through his or her grief, meet with funeral directors and select caskets, figure out readings and choose flowers, all the while supporting others and managing the minutiae of their lives at the same time? I guess I'm going to find out. We've been at the funeral home for several hours selecting things, but my mind is elsewhere. Apparently Jones and Ahmed paid a visit to Nettie and Patrick yesterday too and told them about the cancer, or lack of it. Nettie and Patrick agree it all must be some sort of misunderstanding, but I can't seem to shake the feeling that something isn't right. Why hadn't Dr. Paisley referred Diana to an oncologist? Why weren't there any records of mammograms or ultrasounds? Why would she lie about it? None of it makes sense.
What about the wake? Pearl asks us. Will it be at your mother's house?
Nettie shudders.
No, let's do it somewhere else.
I agree, Ollie says. Knowing Mum died there, it's different now.
How about a local bar or restaurant?
Pearl suggests, and we all mutter our agreement.
Now, for the service. Some people who have non-denominational services like to have a few church hymns. Do you think Diana would...
No,
Ollie and Nettie say in unison.
Mum wasn't really into hymns, Ollie explains.
No hymns, Pearl says, making a note in her paperwork.
That's fine.
While I hadn't thought about it much in the past, Diana's harsh rejection of her Catholic upbringing is curious to me now. I find myself wanting to ask her about it, and I'm hit by a jarring sadness that I can't.
All right, Pearl said. Moving on.
For the most part, Nettie and I do the choosing. Ollie and Patrick sit there like a couple of teenagers, nodding and grunting and looking at their phones. Around lunchtime, Pearl suggests Nettie and I pop down to the corner store for sandwiches.
I'm not hungry, Nettie says. It's important that you eat, Pearl says.
She's entirely firm and also entirely serene.
And grab something for the men while you're at it.
Outside, we shuffle along the street. A train track runs along the side of the road, and the noise of a passing train takes the edge off the silence for 30 seconds. Then it's gone, and there's nothing but the sound of our breathing. Nettie lifts a hand to scratch her nose, and her shirt sleeve rides up, revealing a thick purple ring around her left wrist. "What happened to your wrist?" I ask. Her gaze flickers to me, then back to the road. "What's it to you?"
"Nettie, come on."
"Let's just get the sandwiches, shall we?" she says quietly. We walk a few more paces. "I hate this," I explode, suddenly unable to keep it in any longer. "Diana would hate it too, you know she would." Nettie stops. "Now of all times we should be coming together as a family."
"Family?"
Nettie squares up against me.
"You and Ollie and the kids are a family. Patrick and I, we're just two people. Two people who don't even..."
"I know."
"You don't know. You couldn't possibly know."
I sigh.
"Nettie, I want so much for us to put this behind us. I want to help you through this."
I'm not hopeful, but I think I have a chance. Here, without Patrick, without Ollie, I feel like I might be able to get through to her. And I want to get through to her. There has already been too much loss for this family. First Tom, then Diana. I can't lose Nettie too.
"I don't care what you want."
She turns away and continues walking down the street. It's not until later that I realize she never told me what happened to her wrist. Chapter 15. Diana. The Past. I've heard it said that every parent spends 80% of their energy on one child and spreads the remaining 20% among any other children. Ollie has always been my 80% child. I spent most of his childhood wondering if he was eating enough, learning enough, doing enough. He wasn't the most popular kid in school, but he wasn't a social leper by any means either. His general contentment, which should have comforted me, somehow only served to baffle me. Did he want to invite his little friend over to play, or did he wish I'd stop inviting that friend over? He never seemed to care either way. Nettie, on the other hand, was born so capable and articulate, I never bothered worrying about her. Being her mother was like having a tiny little peer that accompanied me everywhere. If someone picked on her at school, she'd simply have a quiet word with them, saying if they didn't stop being mean, they'd have no friends left, and wouldn't that be silly? When I served them vegetables for dinner, and Ollie, 5 years her senior, refused to eat them, she'd ask him, "Don't you want to be big and strong like a superhero, Ollie?" Once, when Ollie was 11 and Nettie was 6, they'd been swimming in the pool for most of the afternoon when I had to go inside. Ollie and Nettie were both strong swimmers, so it wasn't a big deal to pop back to the house for a short while. "Keep an eye on your sister," I must have said, or something to that effect. I went to the kitchen and started on dinner, peeling potatoes. It was a warm day and the sun beamed in through the window. As I picked up the last potato, a funny feeling came over me. Mother's instinct, perhaps. I should check the kids. When I got outside, I saw a tangle of bodies just under the surface of the water. I didn't pause even to take off my shoes before leaping into the water. I grabbed Nettie first, but Ollie had a hold of her and wasn't letting go. I pulled and twisted her, but he was like an anchor weighing her down. Finally, I gave Ollie a kick in the stomach and she came free. I pushed her to the side of the pool, and a moment later did the same for Ollie. He clung to the side of the pool, blood and water dripping down his face, landing in the hollowed-out part of his collarbones.
"What on earth happened?" I said, panting.
"Ollie did a flip and hit his head," Nettie gasped. "I saw blood and he wasn't moving. I tried to save his life and then he tried to drown me."
I looked at Ollie, sucking in wild breaths at the side of the pool.
"Did you panic, Ollie? Is that why you were holding on to Nettie?"
Ollie didn't reply. He seemed just as confused as Nettie was. That's when I realized. Some people jumped in and tried to save someone who was in trouble. others did anything they could to save themselves. Ollie hadn't meant to drown Nettie. He was simply following his instincts, just as she was following hers. My children had just shown me who they were. When I arrive home, Nettie is sitting on a bar stool in my kitchen, leafing through the newspaper. Her suit jacket is on the counter, and her hair is swept into a very corporate-looking chignon. "Hello, darling," I say, jostling with my bags from the supermarket. Her eyes flicker up from the newspaper. Nettie stops by like this from time to time on her way home from work, sometimes under the guise of dropping something off, sometimes just because. I don't really understand it, but I've come to quite enjoy the routine of it. "Hey, Mum," she says. "I saw your friend Lisa in the supermarket just now." I haul the bags onto the counter. "She mentioned a bunch of you were going to Hong Kong for a girls' trip." "I'm not going," Nettie says.
"Oh, why not?"
She sighs. "Money, time." I nod, but it seems to me that a girls' trip might be exactly what Nettie needs. "Have you seen Lucy and Archie?" I ask her.
"Not since the hospital."
"I've just been to visit them."
"Oh."
Nettie turns the page of the newspaper, studiously uninterested.
"How are they?"
"I think Lucy's had better days, but that's what it's like with a new baby." The clock on the oven catches my attention. It's not even 5 o'clock. "Nettie, shouldn't you be at work?"
"I left early."
I look at her. "Are you allowed to do that?"
"I'm allowed to do anything I like."
I look at her. She's in a strange mood. Her posture is sullen, almost teenage. "Is something the matter, Nettie?" She shakes her head, of course. My daughter, for all her softness and light, is fiercely private, at least with me. She's actually one of only a handful of people who can make me uncertain of myself. I enjoy this about her, the juxtaposition of it. There was a time, though, when Nettie did used to open up to me. When she was younger, I practically had to tell her to stop telling me things. "Some things," I'd say, "are for sharing with your girlfriends, Antoinette." But somewhere along the line, she'd stopped sharing so much. Started talking to Patrick, I assume.
"Are you sure?"
I ask. She'll never divulge that she'd dearly love a baby, that she wished it was her holding a newborn instead of Lucy. I know it's true just the same. The poor girl is so desperate for a baby, it's practically written on her skin. Her polycystic ovaries make it tricky to conceive, but there must be things she can do to help. She's probably already doing things, but she won't tell me and I won't ask. Instead, we'll just be together for a little while, not saying anything at all. "Would you like to stay for dinner?" I ask.
"No," she says. "I need to get home to Patrick."
"Patrick is welcome to join us too," I say dutifully. In the early days, Nettie and Patrick would come to dinner often. They'd retire to the den after dinner, and Patrick would mix drinks and smoke cigars with Tom. Patrick always seemed so comfortable that for a while I'd worried we'd never have a night to ourselves. But a year or two in, he'd stopped coming, save for Christmas and family occasions.
"No," she says. "I'll go home."
"You know, if something is bothering you, you can talk to me about it," I say. I might not be the best conversationalist, but I'm not a bad listener. Nettie looks at me, and for a long moment, I think she might cry. Nettie is not a crier. She hasn't been since she was a very little girl. But a few seconds pass, and Nettie regains her composure, sits straight.
"Thanks, Mum," she says. "But everything is fine."
Chapter 16. Lucy. The Past.
"Are you feeling okay?"
Ollie asks.
I nod gloomily.
Not car sick?
No. I do get car sick, but that's not what's bothering me. We're in the car on our way to the Goodwins Beach House. I understand, of course, that it is a privilege to be miserable about this. There are people with worse problems. Certainly Ollie isn't unhappy about it. He loves Sorrento. All year he romanticizes it, waxing lyrical about how nice it is to have the whole family together under the same roof for a week. He is utterly oblivious to any undercurrents of tension. If I mention anything to him, he always looks baffled.
Mum, stressed? No, that's just how she is. She enjoys the stress.
Perhaps it's just Ollie who enjoys the stress. He's been whistling all morning, and his entire body is growing more spongy and relaxed as we inch along the foreshore in bumper-to-bumper traffic, catching the odd glimpse of sapphire blue through the beach scrub. Whenever I tell anyone my in-laws have a beach house in Sorrento, they make appreciative noises. Sorrento? Ooh la la. I understand why. Tom and Diana's cliff-top beach house is arguably one of the most spectacular houses on the Mornington Peninsula, a 1900s sandstone braced into the cliff with manicured gardens and a whitewashed timber path built down to the beach. There is a pool, a tennis court, and a three-tiered limestone patio with uninterrupted sea views. I hate it.
How on earth can you hate that? Claire demanded recently. I would kill to have a beach house that I could visit whenever I liked. I mean, I'd literally kill for it.
I would kill not to have such a place. For one thing, the Goodwins place is entirely unchild-friendly. Artwork, pottery, and sculptures adorn every wall and surface. I can barely set Archie on the floor without Diana gasping. It's so foreign to me. My own mother couldn't have cared less about artwork or sculptures. If she'd had the chance to be a grandmother, all the artwork on her walls would have been painted by her grandchildren, and she only would have gasped when I told the kids it was bedtime.
Don't be ridiculous, kids. You're staying up late with Nana tonight.